So that's Harry Chapin and A Better Place to Be, chosen by my guest on the line, Derek, who is with us this morning. Thanks for holding.
My pleasure.
And that's better than most on-hold music that you get these days, I would imagine. Even that.
it's incredible. I mean, it's a sad story that doesn't have a happy ending, like life, really, in a lot of ways.
And it is good when you have a song that's it's sort of produced from the heart, you know, and it has a meaning to it as well, which is...
I mean, the guys tell some fabulous stories. And he died, actually, on the way to a gig some while ago now. But if anybody listening to that has not come across Harry Chapin, because he's well known for... WOLD, I Am the Morning DJ.
Oh, yes, I heard that.
And so Cats in the Cradle are his two sort of singles that people are likely to have heard of if they've heard of him at all. But his first half a dozen albums, they are well worth hunting down because they all tell stories like that. Sometimes happy endings, sometimes not, often with a twist. The guy is brilliant.
And this is just something you don't really get so much these days. I mean, there probably are exceptions, but on the whole, music these days is just fairly disposable, isn't it?
Very much so,
I do like the quote. I think it was actually the Eurovision Song Contest on Saturday. Somebody referred to the music industry now as fast food music, which I think that sort of sums it up, doesn't it, really, these days? Which is sad in a way, isn't it?
Yeah, I think what's happened is that I'm not sure there are too many newer eras to explore. That's one of the reasons why, with the book, what I decided to do was I wanted to tell the story from the roots. But I decided at some point I had to finish it, and I thought the last real innovation as such, I think, was almost certainly, I'd say it was punk rock in the mid-70s. Well, not so much last real innovation, but what happened with punk was that it turned full circle, because what had happened in the late 60s, early 70s, prog rock had really taken rock music to the next level with full orchestras, symphony level recordings, guitar solos going on for 20, drum solos going on for 20 minutes. Now, I love that because I'm a drummer. Not many people do. And then punk came along in the UK in the sort of 75, 76, 77, and it turned it all on its head. It was back to, you know, basic three chords, played at a fast old pace, back into small venues.
Yes. Well, we're going to have to take a quick break for the news at 11 o'clock, but if you can stay there, we'll continue this conversation. So much to talk about. Radio Wave. It's Monday morning. This is the Brunchtime Breakfast with me, John Andrews, here till midday today. We're in conversation with Derek. We're talking about his book, Rock and Roll Unraveled. We'll find out more about that in just a tick. And Derek has been on the line, joined the news there. Thank you, Derek. Welcome back to the programme. So tell me a bit about yourself, Derek, then. I mean, you were obviously around in the 60s buying the music, but what were you up to in that era?
Yeah, very much a product of the 60s. I like lots of people that time. I formed a group in about 64. With some friends.
And this was Cleo's mood, wasn't it?
Oh, it was fabulous. A brief flirtation with a bass guitar and decided that I fancied drums. you know. And I had this philosophy of hitting everything as hard as I could, as fast as I could, as often as I could. Very sort of Keith Moon was my idol from The Who. And I was in the band till about 67, and then it was choice then to carry on, or shall I get myself an education? So I did that. But then I carried on. The love of music never stopped. And in the meantime, as life sort of rolled forward, I got involved in record fairs as a dealer. So I specialised in 50s, 60s and 70s collectible vinyl.
Oh, wow.
And that's absolutely fascinating. Because at the record fairs, you meet people who often have very narrow but very, very deep interests in particular individuals or bands, and you have some absolutely fascinating conversations.
I bet you do. I bet you meet some really interesting people, and like you say, people that have got an interest, you're sharing a common interest, and potentially through those conversations you're learning something as well, aren't you?
Absolutely. And then I had an interesting time for a year or so in about 1976 when I decided that for all kinds of personal reasons. I'd become a roadie, a professional roadie, and it came about by accident when I met the guy that used to sort of work with us. He wasn't technically in the band, but he used to work with us on the road and stuff. And he'd carried on and stayed in the music business. And he told me that Pat Travers, a Canadian rock guitarist, was looking for a drum roadie for actually the guy Nico McBrain, who was still is, I think, Iron Maiden's drummer. So I worked with them for a bit, and then I worked with a band called Meal Ticket. And this is 76, so this is the year of pub rock in London. Good time rock and roll in the pubs, and that was a great time. We toured with them. We had a residency in Saint-Tropez for a couple of weeks, and toured Netherlands and Belgium for a couple of weeks.
Oh, that was what an experience! So that must have been.
That was a whole different era, because there I was working with professional musicians, and in Meal Ticket, I mean, they were all very good musicians in their own right. Their problem was, we're talking 1976, and everything was being swept away by punk. The only music genre that record labels and everybody was really interested in was punk. So great bands like Meal Ticket never actually made it to the next stage.
That's
and there was a South Walian band called Racing Cars. They did, had a fabulous single called They Shoot Horses, Don't They? And, you know, they never really managed to rise to the top, because just like in America in, 10 years earlier, really, in the British invasion, when American bands couldn't get a look in, if you weren't punk, you know, it was very difficult to move forward.
Yeah, which is a shame, because you say so many great bands and great sounds, just, you know, because of the whole punk thing, I suppose, couldn't really, you know, sort of get the... couldn't surface above it, really.
Oh, absolutely.
So, yeah. Okay, so your first... Am I right in thinking your first record was the Everly Brothers?
That's right.
Yes, I've got this lined up, actually.
Oh, right, Poor Jenny.
Poor Jenny. So tell me about Poor Jenny.
Well, I could remember buying that at my record store. There was a local record store there. All singles at that time were 6 and 4... which is about 30 new pence or something.
Oh, it's amazing, isn't it?
It's incredible. An album, all the albums were 32 and 6. But I was only earning £5 a week, so 32 and 6, like £1.50, as it were.
A big chunk of your earnings, then.
It's quite a big chunk. I was an apprentice in a steelworks at the time. But I remember I was looking for Lord Rockingham's 11, Hoots Mon, but the shop didn't have that. And I thought, ooh, they've got the Everly Brothers, though. And so I bought that. As well pleased with that. Always liked the Everly Brothers.
Have you still got that first record?
No, very, very sadly. Long before anybody realised that these things were not just collectible, but if you actually hung on to them in good condition, you could retire very early in life on the basis of a good record collection. For some reason, when I was about 16, I needed to raise a little bit of money, probably to buy some drumsticks or something. So I sold my collection at the time, which is probably about 3 albums, which is the Beatles' first album on the black yellow label, the Stones' first album, and a couple of dozen singles, and I needed to raise some money, so I took them to a record shop in Chester.
I bet you regret that now, don't you?
Oh, every minute of every day. I mean, one of my all-time favourite songs, Nut Rocker, Be Bumble and the Stingers.
Oh, yeah, brilliant. I love that.
Was one of them. Yeah, but at that time, it's like, you know, there was no collector's market. I mean, all this didn't come around till the sort of 80s, when people realised that, wow, you know, these songs are really good. That's why now you've got the nostalgia market in terms of bands like the Foremost and Mike Berry. Mark Winter, they're all still on the road on a very regular basis.
Yeah.
People like to listen to that kind of music again.
People like to reminisce, don't they? And it's sort of a connection to their past, almost.
Oh, absolutely.
Yes. So tell me, Derek, about the experience of buying a record back in the sort of the heyday of rock and roll, when you were there buying that Everly Brothers single, Poor Jenny. I mean, listening boobs and things like that.
Well, that's right. I can imagine. I can give you an example of that. about it. It was a little bit later. It was 1967, in fact. The Pink Floyd's first album came out, Piper at the Gates of Dawn. And I thought, oh, that sounds interesting. I'd heard a little bit of, well, I'd heard their singles on the radio. So I cycled to Chester, which doesn't sound that impressive now, 7 miles. But in those days, I was not a big bicyclist, as it were. I got there, and they have had booths on the wall. There were no headphones. And you'd stick your head in this booth, and the guy would put the record on, an actual record player behind the counter. And you'd listen to it there. And I listened to the first side, and I thought, wow, this is weird. So I thought, well, I've got 7 miles to cycle home yet, so at least I should do is listen to the other side.
Oh, yeah.
I thought, whoa, this is even weirder. But I thought, oh, we'll buy it. And I've still got that album.
Oh, that's good.
Pleased. In fact, I was looking at the value of it in the record collector guide, and it's currently valued about £700.
Oh, hang on to that one then.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
Oh, I think that's one I'll be buried with.
Yeah, you won't part with that one. Well, let's hear your first record then, where it all began for you, so the Everly Brothers and Poor Jenny.
Brilliant.
That brought back some memories, didn't it, hearing that?
It certainly did. I mean, I can picture that record shop now. It's a single-story building in Connors Quay. Long since gone.
Mm. Yeah, it's probably a coffee shop or something now.
I think it probably is.
Estate agents or something like that.
Yeah.
So I mentioned earlier you were in a band back in the 60s, but you're currently playing in your brother's band, I believe.
That's right. I mean, he put a band together with. He's 4 years younger than me, and he put a band together with some of his school friends, and they couldn't find a drummer because very few people seem to play the drums nowadays.
That's your niche in the market then, isn't it?
Absolutely. I think it's a good time to be a drummer.
Yeah.
They had some gigs coming up, so I sort of filled in with them, and they never did find a drummer, so I played with them. They don't play very often together because they all live in different parts of the country. But do get together. And one of the great gigs was when I launched the book, it was actually launched at the Cavern Club. Cavern Club in Liverpool.
Oh my goodness.
Playing on the same stage as Paul McCartney played in 1999.
So what was that like? Yeah, you up on stage, was that like a dream come true for you?
Oh, it was absolutely awesome. I mean, the Cavern has... I mean, it is iconic, and a lot of it's to do with the fact that the Beatles, are very much associated with it. But it's got an interesting history in its own right, because the original building, the ground level was all knocked down to make way for... an air vent for Liverpool Underground. That never came about. And they reopened it in the 80s, I think, because the cellars were still intact, and the Cavern now, the footprint, is actually on about 70% of the original cellar. But it was brilliant when we did the launch, because what we did, obviously, I talked through the story of rock and roll from the beginning through to the Sex Pistols. So when we got to the mid-50s, and Bill Haley, we then had a little break while I stepped to the back of the stage, got on the drum kit, and we played Rock Around the Clock.
Brilliant.
Oh, it was fabulous. And we played Substitute, the Who's Substitute.
Oh, I love
which
that song.
I love.
It's a great song.
Part of the way through as well. So, I mean, that was a fabulous day. And it was awesome. You know, it really did feel like you were in the Cavern. So playing a stage that people really like to play.
That's an iconic venue as well.
Oh, without a doubt.
Yes.
I mean, there aren't many that are known worldwide, and I think it's fair to say that the Cavern really is.
Of course, that's where Cilla Black started out, wasn't it? On the on the cloakroom there, isn't it?
Yeah, she worked in a few of the clubs like that. She actually sang with a number of the Liverpool bands at the time, people like King Size Taylor and the Dominoes, and she became very successful. I think she was the third person that Brian Epstein signed up.
Wow, it's amazing. So what's so special then? I guess the question is, why Liverpool? I mean, you know, so many great bands coming out of the city. What is it about Liverpool?
Well, there were a lot of bands there. I think the Beatles were one of the first bands to really crack the charts. Mm. They weren't necessarily the first to record. They failed an audition on the 1st of January 1960. 62, is that right? When Brian Poole and the Tremolos were in, because Brian Poole was a London-based band, and you know it was an EMI session in London. But I think there were sort of two different scenes. In London, it was very much dominated more by the sort of Crawdaddy Club and R&B bands like the Yardbirds and the Stones. Mm. But I think what happened was the Merseybeat, the Beatles were very much the ones to crack America. So, you know, you very much seem to think of as Liverpool. But, I mean, there were so many bands and so many clubs. I mean, there were literally dozens, if not hundreds, of clubs in the late 50s and early...
I bet a great atmosphere 50s. In the city as well. You know, if you're going out in the evening and you experience all those clubs firsthand, as I'm sure you did.
Yeah, we used to go to the second half of the all-nighter at the Cavern when I was in the group Cleo's Mood back in the 60s. If we were doing a local gig, we'd then drive from North Wales or Chester, wherever it was, through the Mersey Tunnel, and we're very careful not to, or rather hoping we wouldn't have to stop because the starter motor didn't work. And there was a very, very big fine for being towed out of the Mersey Tunnel.
Oh, dear.
But unfortunately, it never happened.
You avoided that one then.
Oh, that was so. We dodged a bullet there. So
what was the car? Can you remember? What car were you in?
It was a Bedford van.
Oh, my God.
Because, you know, it had all the gear in the back. Probably didn't lock. So, I mean, leaving a car parked overnight, not just in a Liverpool car park, but any car park with a whole load of equipment in, you probably wouldn't think about doing nowadays.
It's all glamorous rock and roll business, isn't it? Yeah.
Oh, it is.
Yeah, so tell me then about the book. It's available. How do we get hold of it?
Well, in the UK, it can be ordered at any bookshops. There are bookshops progressively more storing it. But it's available very easily on online, Amazon. And because of the name Shelmerdine and Rock and Roll Unraveled as a title, it's very easy to find it.
Yes.
But a great way to find it is on my website, www.rockandrollunraveled.com. And then there's a whole load of direct links to websites and information about shops if you happen to live in certain parts of the country. But it's available. I mean, people have bought it in America and Australia. So it's one good thing about the internet is it does make the book widely available.
Absolutely.
Online. So that's brilliant.
And from you, as the author of the book, it's great to sort of get your book into different countries and other people can. I'm sure there's a lot of interest sort of from overseas about the British rock and roll scene.
Well, absolutely. I mean, certainly up to the 70s. You know, Britain and America have very much dominated the scene, and a lot of the classic music that influenced today's artists and artists of the 80s and 90s comes from the 50s, 60s, and 70s.
Yes,
I mean, music has just really kept progressing forward.
Yeah, it is definitely. You know, there's a progressive thing, isn't it? Music. It sort of goes through stages, and then you find out, oh, it's so and so's got a new single out, and you listen to it, and you think, hang on a minute, this sounds familiar.
Absolutely.
Get that lot.
There are only so many notes.
Exactly. When people start sampling things and all that sort of stuff.
Right? Oh, exactly.
Yes. Okay. Just finally, what do you think where do you think music will go from here? Where do you think we'll be in the future?
I don't know. It's hard to tell. I think that the next step, at some point, the reality TV-based road into music will come to a natural end.
Yes.
And I think then we'll probably start to see more innovation back into music. But I think what is interesting is that the internet itself is a way that quite a few musicians and singers find fame. They become very widely seen on various internet type sites, and that's a terrific route to market.
And this, yeah, obviously you're getting yourself out there as a solo musician without the sort of the backing of big sort of production companies and things. You can get your music, put it on the internet, and it can go anywhere from there, can't it?
So. That's right. And I think, you know, once the wonderful as they are, the Simon Cowell programs find, you know, at some point there will be a natural end to them. And I think then it will enable the other avenues to become much more accessible, as it were, to and desirable to people, rather than everybody looking. I mean, it's sad in a way that People are looking for sort of instant gratification in terms of being an overnight star.
Yes, enter a competition and win the chance to be a pop star sort of thing. Yeah, that mentality. It's going to be interesting to see where things go, but it's always good to reminisce and look back at the history and see where we come from with music. So, Derek, thanks so much for coming on the programme, the book Rock and Roll Unraveled. Give us your website again so we can find out more.
That's www.rockandrollunraveled.com. I'm also very active on the Twitter and Facebook fronts. So they're the same sort of things. Twitter, it's RNR, Unraveled, and Facebook is Rock and Roll Unraveled, at La Rock and Roll Unraveled. So it's all variations on a theme. But what I like to do on Twitter and Facebook, I post stuff on a daily basis, what happened today, and originals and cover versions and all that kind of stuff. So if you're interested in this sort of stuff, the website and the two social media sites have an awful lot of information going on them.
Well, we'll have a little look at that later, and I'm sure a lot of people listening will be looking you up on the social media and the internet as well. So, Derek, thanks so much for coming on the programme today.
My pleasure. I really enjoyed it.
Thank you. Great to have you on, and we're going to finish with a bit of the Little Richard and Tutti Frutti.